Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Guys, Here We Still Stand is sold out. I told you that that was going to happen. And you're probably sitting there and you're thinking, oh man, I was kind of meaning to do that. Or, well, I lived close and I thought that surely he was just trying to sell more tickets. Nope. I wasn't lying to you guys. It is over. It is sold out. But good news, you can sign up for the live stream. That's right. Maybe you're just like a listener of this podcast, and this is the only thing about 1517 that you ever do. And I would recommend sign up for the live stream, and you can get to hear Chad and me and a whole bunch of other people give some talks. And here's the wonderful thing. That live stream is absolutely free. All you do is sign up for it. You just type in your email address. We'll send you a link at the appropriate time. I will put a link in the show notes that says HWSS live stream. Just click on that link, sign up. You get all the information, and you can watch at least all the plenaries from the comfort of your own home. So go ahead and do that. Chad, we are in 2 Kings chapter 8, starting in verse 1 today, and we have went through a drought. Went through a famine, went through some rabid inflation going on where you could money that seemed as not worth much at all. You had to spend an exorbitant amount of it to get things that you don't really want. And all of that has been solved by Elijah, or at least solved by God, and Elijah knew it was going to be so. And now we go back to somebody who we haven't heard from in a little while.
Yeah, we're going to reacquaint ourselves with the woman that we heard about a few chapters back. So this is 2 Kings 8, and we heard about her back in 2 Kings chapter 4. This is the lady that I recognized that Elisha was a man of God, and you know, made him a little house, mm-hmm. little room on her roof, and then he promised her a son, and then when the son grew up, he had some sort of something happened with his head anyway. And then Elisha restored him to life. So this is the same woman. And we haven't heard about her in a while. And we're also, in this same little section, are going to hear about another guy we haven't heard from in a couple chapters, Gehazi, who was a servant of Elisha. So what happens? Well, we're told in verse 1 that Elisha had said to the woman, so this is kind of a retrospect here, had said to the woman whose son he had restored to life, "Arise and depart with your household and sojourn wherever you can, because the Lord has called for a famine and it will come upon the land for 7 years." Another instance of the prophet. He just knows this stuff. I mean, we can kind of get used to this, you know. Oh yeah, a prophet says this is going to happen. This is how long it's going to last. But just stop and realize for a minute how phenomenal this is. I mean, I can't tell you what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, I know what's going to happen at the end of time. I've read it in a book called Revelation, tells me what's going to happen. But I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Don't ask me what's going to happen in 7 years. But Elisha knows.
I don't know how the weather works over there in Texas. But even our meteorologist mostely can't get it right for 24 hours from now.
They're false prophets.
Yeah, false prophets, man. They can't tell me about a 7-year drought. They can't tell me for certain whether or not it's going to rain or not. They don't know. So yeah.
Elisha is the best weatherman who's ever been.
Yeah, if he says exactly it's not going to rain for seven years, it ain't going to rain for 7 years.
Isn't it? It's not going to rain. Yeah. So he cares about this woman. And maybe he told her this, you know, right after he raised her son back to life. We're not told exactly when this happened, but whenever it was, he wants to give her a very helpful heads up. Hey, there's a famine coming, not going to be much to eat. So why don't you leave and go someplace where there will be something to eat and, you know, pack a lot of stuff because you're going to be there for a while. It's not going to be over in a few weeks or a year. It's going to take 7 years. So by this point, she realizes, hey, if the prophet tells you to do something, or if the prophet says such and such is going to happen, then it is. Listen to him. So she she does exactly what he says. She arose and did according to the word of the man of God. Always a good thing to do.
Now you have to assume this famine is the famine that we just heard about.
I'm assuming so. Yeah. The famine that ended up causing such a terrible conditions in Samaria.
So you have back-to-back famines, which would be a real bummer. I know this is going back a little ways, but we had talked about how you had this scene where, you know, you had Syria and just battle, and then like that got put on hold, but then it said, oh wait, now they came and they did this thing, and we were talking about time, like we thought time had passed, and I think this is more evidence of that you had 7 years, probably, because we assume this is the same famine. So you have a seven-year period. One of the reasons that Elijah was able to get them out of this invasion is throw in this huge feast for your enemies and this kind of stuff. You assume there's not a famine when that's happening, because that's right. You're not able to do that. And then we hear kind of picking up towards this invasion, and we're at the end of a famine. And so somewhere in there, I think you have like a seven-year period. There's a seven-year time period, so there's more evidence that Chad and I are correct in assuming that the Assyrians didn't eat that food, go home, go to sleep, get up the next morning, and do it again.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, not everything in, Old Testament or New Testament is in chronological sequence.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if you and I talked about this off air or if we talked about it last episode, but the rabbis had a saying that there is neither early nor late in the Torah, which was just kind of a catchphrase for them that meant things aren't always in sequence. You know, you'll have stuff even in Genesis, which is obviously out of sequence, but you know, they just the material is arranged in such a way sometimes to where it's thematically connected, not necessarily chronologically following one event after another. So good case of that happening here. So there's a famine, 7 years, a woman gets up, leaves. She went with her household, and she sojourned in the land of the Philistines for 7 years. And at the end of the 7 years, when the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, she went to appeal to the king for her house and her land. So this must have been a relatively geographically constricted famine. I mean, the land of the Philistines is not that far away. It's not like, you know, she went from even California to New York. I mean, this is a pretty small area. She's up in northern Israel, and the land of the Philistines was adjacent to the western side of Judah, right there along the sea. So must have been a pretty small area that was affected, but nevertheless, it lasted for a long time, and they must have had food in the land of the Philistines.
Well, you can imagine. I mean, this stuff doesn't make sense to us because it's so easy for us to get around, and you know. But think about it, even in this country. So I lived in Arizona for a little while, and let me tell you, Arizona is a drought. That's what it is.
It always is in drought.
Yeah, and if you weren't piping water in from the Colorado River, like, you can't live there. Not at this time, you know. Like, we're able to do it because of infrastructure, and we've solved these kind of problems. But it's not hard to imagine. I mean, imagine, you know, California has times where the whole state's on fire, it seems like, or they'll have massive heat waves, or they won't have rain for months and months and months and months. And it's a problem, but it's not the kind of problem it would have been back a long time ago, because we are bringing water in. We'll ship stuff in. We'll drive stuff in. We'll fly stuff in. Whatever we got to do. So it's not hard to think of a place. So Arizona is not that far from Colorado, but one of those places got a lot more water than the other one before you had cars or planes or any of that stuff. It's a little bit of a journey.
Yeah. Yeah. You did it all on foot, most likely.
Die along the way. You're walking through the Arizona desert trying to get to Colorado is a dangerous thing back before air conditioning and vehicles.
Right. Yeah. There's so many things that we, in our modern world take for granted. I never, and maybe this is partly because I'm not a farmer, but I never worry about drought.
Yeah.
You know, I just was reading our local paper that we're way below our average rainfall, and our aquifer is low and all those sorts of things. But it doesn't affect me in any real, you know, perceptible sort of way.
It's because you go down to the Walmart and buy 4 cases of bottled water and you're good to go, right?
Yeah, exactly. I turn on my faucet. I've always got water. Or I go buy water. Yeah, whatever it might be. And HEB, our local grocery store, always has food on the shelves. You know, it's not a thing that most people listening to this podcast worry about. But that's because we live in a very different age than most people throughout history lived in, where, yeah, you are worried about drought because that might mean you or your children are going to starve to death. So
also, now imagine that Colorado, in this Arizona-Colorado comparison, isn't just another state. It's a different country that doesn't like you.
Yes, right. That's a whole other issue, right? We don't know if she knew people down there. That's just where she goes. So is she going to be safe? I mean, anything could happen. She might flee a drought and end up in prison or more likely a slave somewhere. So yeah, it's a dangerous situation all the way around. But things turned out well for her, thanks be to God. And she comes back. But when she gets back, things are not great. I mean, the drought's over. That's good. But evidently, while she was gone, her land was lost. Now, we're not exactly told who took it, but I can't help but wonder if it's actually the king who basically took over land that was abandoned by people who were fleeing from the famine. It would make sense. You know, kings did this quite frequently. And she does appeal to the king for her house and her land. Now, she could have been appealing to the king in the sense of asking for justice because, you know, so-and-so has taken over her land while she was gone. But it seems to make a lot more sense to me that she's appealing actually not just to the king as the king, but also to the very person who has taken control of her land while she was gone to the land of the Philistines. So verse 4 tells us that while all this is going on, the king was talking to Gehazi, the servant of the man of God. So Gehazi, you'll probably remember, was last encountered when Naaman, the Syrian general, came down to be cleansed of his skin disease. And after he was cleansed, after that whole kind of back and forth, and he took off, and Elisha would not receive any gifts from Naaman. Gehazi sees dollar signs, and he's like, oh, well, the prophet really screwed up here. I'm going to make sure that I get something out of it. So he pursues them. He gets some stuff from Naaman, who's willing to give him these gifts, tells him this whole made-up story. Well, at the end of it, then Gehazi is confronted by the prophet, and this very skin disease of which Naaman was cleansed now is going to cling to Gehazi. So that was the last we heard of him. Well, now here he is. We assume he still has this skin disease, and he's in this dialogue with the king. So I don't know what happened. I mean, did he like leave the prophet service and somehow get hired by the king or what? It's an odd scenario that is pictured here where either he's the current or the former servant of the prophet, and now he's just, you know, having this talk with the king of the northern kingdom.
I do like this statement where he's talking to Gehazi, and the king is saying, tell me all the great things that Elijah has done. And Gehazi doesn't say, well, let me tell you how I got this skin condition. That was a wild story.
Yeah. Edited that part out, yeah. Let me talk about this time Naaman, you know, that Syrian general came down to see us. Yeah, it is rather an odd conversation. Hey, tell me about Elisha. Tell me about all the great things that he did. Now, the king should know some of these things. And the king also should remember, oh, yeah, that time, remember when you wanted to chop his head off, but he promised that there would be a reversal of the famine? That's another great thing that Elisha did. So anyway, they're talking back and forth. Verse 5, while he was telling the king how Elisha had restored the dead to life. So Gehazi is like in the very middle of telling this story about, yeah, there was this woman and she had a son and the son died and the prophet came and he raised the son back to life. He's telling this whole story. And then behold, we're told, it's a great place for a behold to occur. While they're talking about this, behold, the very woman whose son he had restored to life appealed to the king for her house and her land. So Gehazi said, no doubt with a kind of a shocked tone of voice, my lord, O king, here is the woman, and here is her son, whom Elisha restored to life. So the very people that we were talking about are now standing in front of you.
This is one of those things where if this happens, whatever she's about to ask is like something you need to do.
Yeah. If she asks for half your kingdom, you better hand it over.
It just seems like a little too spooky. Not to, like, you're like, what does she need? Well, she needs her land back. All right, like, because this whole thing is a little serendipitous. I'm gonna go ahead and just take it. So, and we'll see. I don't, not to spoil it. Like, he's not an idiot, but the Bible is full of people that do things that don't make a lot of sense sometimes. And he could have went the other way. And if he had, we would have a very long conversation probably on this podcast about, like, how in the world are you going to be like, nope.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. This is an unmissable divine coincidence.
Yes.
And when those happen, do the right thing.
Yeah.
This is not mere chance that these two things happen.
Just really, really ignoring what God is trying to tell you to do if you do that.
Yeah, don't be that guy. So the king asked her, and she told him. So he asked her, you know, what she wanted, what she was appealing for, and she told him. And he does the right thing. You know, this is a king that has not always done the right thing. But in this case, he does. He appointed an official. He didn't just say, you know, yeah, we'll take care of it and then let it die in paperwork somewhere. No, he actually appointed an official for her, saying, restore all that was hers, together with all the produce of the fields from the day that she left the land until now. That's a lot more than she bargained for.
Well,
you know, she probably asked if she could have the land back, but she wasn't guaranteed. She was probably never entered her mind that she was going to get actually paid for all the produce from the land that was produced, however much it was. I mean, this was a famine.
I was about
to say,
a lot, he probably gave her a sack of pigeon dung and said, this is all we got from the land. It's been
dung,
a rough 7 years.
Yeah. So hopefully it was at least a sizable amount to where she could kind of restart her life there. So back to, you know, this king making the right decision, just to help us all recall who this guy is. So this is the grandson of Omri. Omri, this is some usually called the Omride dynasty. So Omri, who was a bad dude, northern kingdom. And then his son was Ahab. Of course, we know Ahab was a bad dude. And then Ahab had a son who died while he was king. And then his brother, who's this guy, takes over office. So this is Jehoram. He goes by both names. And then we've been dealing with this guy for a few chapters now. He's going to be dead pretty soon in the next chapter or so. But, you know, of the Omri dynasty, all these kings that came from Omri, he's really been the best. I mean, at least he's listened to the prophet. He did want to kill him that one time, but he has listened to him and he makes a good decision here. He acts actually with some regal mercy and even largesse by giving her not just like the land, but the produce, the fields that was produced. So, he's kind of the best of the bad part to this dynasty. And I accent that because what we've been waiting for ever since 1 Kings 19, so a bunch of chapters ago, what we've been waiting for is for the divine axe to fall on the house of Ahab. So Elijah was told this was going to happen. Elisha has spoken about it, but it hadn't happened yet. We went through Ahab, we went through his first son, and now we're in his second son's reign. And all this time, we're waiting for the judgment to come. And Elisha, rather than bringing that judgment, so far anyway, has been acting with mercy. He's raising the dead. He's healing the sick. He is taking care of, you know, poisonous water. He's doing all these good things, but he's certainly not what you think of as a fire and brimstone kind of prophet. I mean, he's out doing Jesus sorts of things.
Yeah.
He's healing. He's providing food. He's doing all these wonderful things. And so you kind of get the impression as you're reading along, it's like, well, is judgment ever going to happen? I mean, is this threat from God, more than a threat, this promise of judgment that's going to fall on the house of Ahab, ever going to happen? And we're going to find out very soon that yes, indeed, that God had not forgotten, the judgment was coming. But it seems to me that what's going on here is that God has delayed the judgment because he's wanting to use the ministry of Elijah to minister to the faithful of the land, to produce around him sons of the prophets, to, as it were, kind of provide a righteous foundation that the nation can have after this dynasty is going to be destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously the judgment is coming, but I mean, Elijah and Elisha feels very similar to sort of John the Baptist and Jesus. You know, so John the Baptist is the fiery preacher, right? He's telling kings that the judgment of God is coming for them. He's rebuking them out in public, and he's, you know, calling the Pharisees a brood of vipers and all this kind of stuff. And he's just a wild guy. You know, he's out there eating stuff in the wilderness. This is all very Elijah kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you have Elisha, who seems a lot like Jesus, who he's like raising the dead and like, you know, he's feeding people and, you know, all this kind of stuff. He's even got like a really, you know, kind of thick-headed disciple. It's very Jesus-like. That's
very familiar. Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, there is this very Christ-like quality to Elisha's ministry, and a very John the Baptist quality to Elijah's. And I think that the gospel writers portray that on purpose. Mm-hmm. They're wanting us to see that in the lives of John and of Jesus. After all this time, a very Christ-like ministry of healing and restoration and all those sorts of wonderful things. Well, as we'll see in just a minute, the end is going to come. And when it comes, it's going to be it's going to be a bloody end. Let's put it that way. We're going to see a lot of pretty terrible things happen. I mean, if we want to kind of continue the parallel, I mean, the same thing happens finally with the ministry of the new and the greater Elisha, right? After doing all these good things and healings and miracles and gathering around him thick-headed disciples, finally the worst comes. You know, it's a terrible, bloody, horrific judgment, and that's his crucifixion. That's finally when the judgment does come, and the axe falls, and the Son of God is put to death for our transgressions.
Well, it's where
in that way the parallel is even there.
Yeah, I think it's sort of where, with like all things that point to Jesus or that sort of look like a shadowy Jesus, where they change a little bit is, so you have Elisha and he's doing all these Jesus-like things, and you're like, oh, I can see it. And then we're going to get to the point where judgment comes upon the people, and where all parallels sort of fall short of being actually like Jesus is where the judgment does come, but where nobody is like Jesus is where, when the judgment comes, the judgment comes on Jesus, and no one else gets to be that person. And you can be all kinds of types and shadows of Jesus right up until the cross, but that is, as Jesus says, like, I don't share my glory with anyone. And by that, he doesn't mean I'm some sort of person who only cares about my own, my own praise and adoration, but that his glory is the cross and that this he must do alone. And so whatever types you have of Christ, the cross is where they sort of all end, and that's Jesus and Jesus alone. And you can see the type in the sense that judgment comes. Unfortunately, Elijah can't take the judgment of God for the people. You're going to need the actual Christ for that.
Yeah, you need God himself for that. Yeah, that's the theme of Hebrews, right? That all these things in the Old Testament, whether the priesthood or whether the sacrifices or the tabernacle or you name it, all those things were fine. I mean, they were great in their own way, but they were by no means the solution.
Right.
They were by no means not the superior thing. They all pointed in their own incompleteness and inadequacies. They pointed forward to that which was to come. And that perfect thing that was to come, whether priest or sacrifice or tabernacle, is Jesus himself.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, Elijah can, you know, feed the hungry and heal the sick and raise the dead, but he cannot take away your sin. He cannot take the wrath of God on your behalf. This is something he cannot do.
Yeah, that job description has been saved for one person and one person only. that was verse six, that one, verses one through six kind of reintroduce us to the Shunammite woman. And now we're going to shift to something else. We're going to see Elisha. He's going to take a little trip up north. So verse seven says that Elisha came to Damascus. So this is rather unusual. He's taken himself outside the promised land. He did that early on. He crossed the River Jordan with Elijah, saw Elijah taken up in the chariots of fire and the whirlwind and all that. And then he crossed back into the promised land. Now he's going to leave the promised land again. He's going north to Syria or Aram. Depending on which translation you use, I think the older translations would always translate this as Aram, A-R-A-M. Newer translations like the ESV will translate it as Syria, but same place, Aram, Syria, Arameans, Syrians. So he goes to Damascus, he goes to capital Syria, and Ben-Hadad is the king of Syria, and he's sick. So he finds out somehow, it was told to him, word gets out that Elisha is in the region. So it was told him, the man of God has come here. So the king, being sick, said to Hazael, now we need to talk about him in just a second. The king said to Hazael, take a present with you and go to meet the man of God and inquire, I love this, inquire of Yahweh through him, saying, shall I recover from this sickness? So often it's the non-Israelites, it's the Gentiles who really understand how things should be happening. Especially the Syrians. I mean, this is the Syrian general Naaman is the one who goes all the way down into the northern kingdom to get cleansed by Elisha, and now we have a Syrian king who's saying, "Hey, I'm sick." Evidently, this was he didn't just have a cold; he was pretty ill because he was afraid he was gonna die. So he says, "Well, go talk to the prophet and have him inquire of Yahweh whether I'm going to live or not."
Do you wonder if Nahum has anything to do with this? Like, as far as the fact that this king would even consider such a thing? He does know. I mean, so I'm assuming Nahum and this king know each other.
That's probably what happened.
And Nahum goes off with a skin condition and comes back without one. And now maybe he's not sitting there being like, hey, I'm a believer in Yahweh now, but maybe he is. Or, I mean, a time has elapsed. Maybe they've had conversation. It seems like there's something up here where this guy is sick and someone's like, hey, yo, that the prophet is here. And that's the same prophet that helped Nahum out, got rid of that for him. Dude, go get a present and find out if there's anything this guy can do for me.
Yeah. I think you can see the impact of Naaman's cleansing in stories like this. I mean, you can't keep that quiet. And, no doubt the king talked to him about it. He said, hey, what's the deal? You left. And, we talked about this before you left. Now you come back, your skin disease is cured. How did it happen? And so he tells him the story. And of course, the Syrians were well acquainted with Elisha. They tried to capture him that one time. He surrounded the city, and he leads them like a bunch of puppy dogs to the center of Samaria, and they feed them and then send them on their way. And then, the other time they surrounded the city and they had to flee in the middle of the night because they thought they were being attacked. So yeah, people in the north in Syria, they know who this guy is. And so they realize, hey, this is the prophet of Yahweh. So he's trustworthy. We should listen to him. Now about this Hazael, who's he? Well, we're going to find out a lot more about this guy. He's going to be part of this chapter, and we're going to see what the prophet says to him in just a minute. But we've actually encountered his name before. You've probably forgotten it because it's been so long ago, but if you go back to 1 Kings chapter 19, this is when Elijah had fled from Jezebel. He went all the way down to Mount Sinai, and he has, the various theophany, the wind and the fire and whatnot. And then God speaks to him in that still small voice. After that, God told Elijah this. So I'm reading from 1 Kings 19. Return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And then he also says, Yehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And then Elisha shall be anointed by you to be the prophet in your place. Well, Elijah did one out of those three things. He did anoint Elisha to be a prophet in his place. But for whatever reason, it's kind of one of those unsolved mysteries. Elijah did not anoint Yehu. Elijah did not anoint Hazael. And so far up to this point, neither has Elisha. This is kind of one of those delayed judgments that I was talking about. It's about to happen, though. We've been waiting since 1 Kings 19, and now it's going to happen. Hazael, that we'll find out more about as the story goes on, is going to be anointed. He's going to be a terrible nuisance to the northern kingdom. He's going to kill a lot of people, just some pretty gruesome stuff, actually. Up to this point, Hazael is a nobody. I mean, he's a servant, but we don't really know anything about him. In fact, there's an Assyrian document that speaks of Hazael, and it describes him as son of a nobody. So this is, of course, the Assyrians' way of just throwing shade over their enemies. But yeah, he's described as a son of a nobody. So maybe he was just kind of an upstart. We don't know enough about his history to say, but he is going to end up being a major character. And if anyone out there listening has ever heard of the Tel Dan inscription, it was a huge archaeological find in, I think it was the late, was it the 1980s, 1990s? Anyway, it's a fairly recent find. And so the Tel Dan inscription talks about all these victories that Assyrian king had over a bunch of other kings and kingdoms. And in there, it's an Aramaic, and it mentions the victory over the house of David. This is a famous inscription that was found at Dan, which is the northernmost city of the northern kingdom. It's famous because it mentions by name the house of David. So, you know, for those who like to compare archaeological evidence to the historicity of the Bible, that becomes a major argument in favor of that. But anyway, I say all that because in this Tel Dan inscription, talking about this Syrian king, most scholars that I've read agree that it is Hazael that's being talked about. So anyway, this guy ends up, that we're introduced to here, that we heard about way back in 1 Kings 19, that we're actually going to get to know now. He's a big player in ancient Near Eastern history and also here in 2 Kings.
And a
son of a nobody.
Yeah. That's my new insult going forward.
Yeah, I wish I knew what it was in the original whatever that was in the Assyrian. It could be a great insult that you could use. Nobody would know what you're talking about. You son of a nobody. So this is this son of a nobody. Is the servant of the king, and the king says, hey, go find out from the prophet if I'm going to get well or not. So Hazael goes out to meet him, and he certainly took a present. We're told that he took 40 camel loads full of all the kinds of goods of Damascus. Now, if you know Elisha, you know this is going to do absolutely no good because he is not impressed with anybody's wealth.
I have to wonder if, you know, Nahum's talking to the king, and the king's like, hey, does it cost anything to kind of, you know, what do I need to do here? And Nahum's like, no, well, actually, at first it didn't, but then his servant did come and take quite a bit of stuff from me. So maybe it wouldn't hurt to have some stuff.
Be prepared. You know, you never know. Maybe the prophet doesn't need it, but maybe his servant does. So just to be on the safe side, take 40 camels.
40
that
camels.
Should probably cover the cost. So we got these 40 camels loaded down, and he finds him. He came, that is, Hazael came and stood before the prophet and said, your son, interesting way to speak of the king. It's a term of respect, but still, your son, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you, saying, shall I recover from the sickness? Pretty straightforward message that he's relaying. And Elisha said to him, this could be translated various ways in the Hebrew, but we'll just kind of go with what the ESV has here. Elisha responds, "Go say to him, you shall certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me that he shall certainly die." It's like, you say that again now?
This is
the Lord has shown me that you shall certainly recover, but also that he shall certainly die. It's a bit of a riddle there.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the illness that just going to kill you, but soon something is going to kill you. I mean, the only way to go back with this news is like with the old good news, bad news thing to the king. You know, I've got good news and bad news. Which one do you want?
Which you want first? Yeah, the sickness. Good news is, yeah, this sickness definitely will not kill you. Oh, that's good. What's the bad news? Well, you're going to die.
Yeah.
That's the bad news. So Hazael is kind of stunned here. He fixed his gaze and stared at him. We're not told who the he and the him are, but contextually, it seems as if Hazael is kind of dumbfounded. He's just staring at the prophet until he was embarrassed. So he just kind of taken aback by this news. Probably he's also trying to figure out what in the world this means. And then the man of God wept. This reminds me of Jesus weeping over Jerusalem. You know, he knows the judgment's going to come, but there's nothing he can do about it. He still has to speak the truth. So the man of God wept. And Hazael's like, "Why are you crying? Why does my Lord weep?"
This right here, this would be so unsettling if this happened to you.
Yeah. It'd be major unsettling.
I mean, this is... You don't want this.
You don't want this, no.
You ask someone why they're crying, and this is what they tell you. This would be quite disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, he might think, yeah, well, the prophet's weeping because, you know, he doesn't like the fact that the king is going to die or whatever it might be. You know, that might be a presumption that you could make here, but that is not the reason the prophet is weeping. So Elisha gave him this answer. He says, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set on fire their fortresses, and you will kill their young men with a sword, and dash in pieces their little ones, and rip open their pregnant women." Whew. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't know that you're that guy, and then you're told that you're that guy, that's got to be... that's got to be a horrifying thing to hear.
Yeah, yeah. And you can kind of see the response. He says, Hazael says, "What is your servant? Who is but a dog? He's the son of a nobody, right? Yeah, I'm a dog." This is we've heard this language before. David used it, I think, when he was referring to himself. I'm a nobody. I'm a dog. I'm a servant that I should do this great thing. And Elisha answered him. He says, "Well, here's how. The Lord has shown me that you are to be the king over Israel." That's it. So we'll kind of wrap up here. We'll talk about this some more in the next episode, but let me kind of finish this section. This is verses 14 and 15. "Then he departed from Elisha and came to his master, who said to him, 'What'd you find out? What did Elisha say to you?' And he answered," he gave him half the answer. He says, "He told me that you would certainly recover." So he gave him the first part of that. "But the next day, Hazael took the bedcloth and dipped it in water and spread it over his face until he died. And Hazael became king in his place." So I'm guessing between when he was shocked, dumbfounded by what the prophet told him, on that long ride back with those 40 camels still laden with the goods of Syria, he got to thinking. And then he got to planning, and then he got to plotting, and then he decides what he's going to do. And at least so far, it worked.
Yeah, it seems as though he's heard this word about who he is, and he got on with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's going to make sure that prophecy is fulfilled.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wild thing to have the prophet tell you, "Your master, you know, the king, he would certainly recover from this, but he is going to die." And then you determine that, okay.
You determine the means whereby his death is going to happen.
It's almost like, I mean, you can't know this, but, you know, he's saying, "Look, who am I? Like, how am I going to manage to do all of this terrible stuff that you're talking about?" And Elijah tells him, well, you're going to be king. And it's almost like he's on the way home. It occurs to him that I could achieve this station easily by the king is sick. I'll just kill him. And I'll kill him in such a way that it'll just maybe look like he died from his sickness or whatever. And you know what, king? It hadn't occurred to me before, but maybe I will be king.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's... I think that's precisely the chain of events. Yeah, it's a strange, this whole encounter is very strange when you think, it's just psychologically, you think about what's happening there with the prophet, with Haziel, and what's going through his mind as he plans and plots and carries this out. And we'll see what happens in the next episode. But yeah, everything that Elisha said he was going to do, unfortunately, he does. He is going to be a very bloodthirsty enemy to the Northern Kingdom in the next few chapters.
Well, we will have to leave it there because we are out of time, and we will find out about all of that in the upcoming episodes. Chad, I'll see you next week.
See you then.